What is up, you guys? Welcome back to The Meaning Of, or if you're checking out us out for the first time, make sure you drop a like and subscribe because we have some film content for you. I am Sabrina Ramirez and I am here with RB3. And today we are talking about Nia DaCosta. Nia DaCosta has definitely been in the conversation for quite a bit of time, even with her very, very young career, only 31 years old at the time that we're filming this. RB3, when you hear Nia DaCosta, what's kind of the first thing that comes to mind for you?
I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind for like a lot of industry people is like that she's going to be directing the next Captain Marvel sequel, you know, and you know, that's just really, you know, that's what the town we live in, Hollywood, you know, when people do a good movie, they tend to, the Marvel film tends to be the upgrade, the promotion. So, you know, I'm curious about that, but for me personally, that's probably what I thought of Nia DaCosta before Candyman. After Candyman, I think of her achievement as being the first Black woman to ever open a film number one at the box office. That's a major, major accomplishment. Yeah. So shout out to her for making history. That's really groundbreaking stuff. And I hope she continues to break new ground and new records and do new amazing things because I think she's amazingly talented.
Yeah. When I think of Nia DaCosta, I think about somebody who is able to tell like really, really great storytelling through all these different aspects and environments. We've seen she only has two feature films that have come out so far, most recently Candyman. But yeah, she's on that Marvel train. She's following the Ryan Coogler and the Destin Daniel Cretons of like young, talented filmmakers who start off with their indie films and then move on to these huge projects. And she, I believe now is the youngest person to ever helm a Marvel film in the future. It was Ryan Coogler. And then she was even younger than him, only 31 years old. And just a little bit about her background for anyone who might not know, she grew up in New York and then she went to NYU, Tisch School of the Arts. Everybody knows that's very elite arts filmmaking school. And she always cites Martin Scorsese as one of her kind of like inspirations behind her films and her filmmaking, which I find really fascinating, especially like RB3 talking to you, where you just graduated film school not too long ago and you love Scorsese. So you guys kind of have that connection there.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming a New Yorker in there is like always going to say Scorsese. I feel like New Yorkers, they always like stick close to like who's close to home from, you know, oh, they always going to love Scorsese. They always going to love Spike Lee. They always going to love the Knicks. But I'm totally kidding. I think you can see it in their filmography too. You can see the way that it's not directly in her style because obviously Scorsese has a very specific style. But I think in the caliber of which she incorporates the real life reality into her filmmaking. You know, when you look at something like Little Woods, it's very like grounded, very close to home, very like sensibility, like very actor driven. I think that's a lot of what you see in like early Scorsese work, like Mean Streets and things like that. And then plus when you look at something like Candyman, which is a little bit more of like an upgrade in budget, it could have been easy to make just another slasher movie. I mean, we've seen the slasher movie remade in today's era. We've seen The Nightmare on Elm Street be remade by Michael Bay and all the other like crazy remakes they've
Friday
like
the
13th. Done.
Friday the 13th. There was a bunch of them. And a lot of the times they fail because I feel like they don't introduce anything new. And with this one, she was kind of able to do that. And she brought it to a different direction, kind of took a pivot and made it something more interesting. So I love that you mentioned that with like Scorsese. Cause yeah, her directing style is very much so her own, but you know, she's from New York. She has to say Scorsese.
It's good, New York.
She also mentioned like Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola. So of course, like the film student essentials basically is like what that is for a good reason. But she finished school and she worked as a TV production assistant. She wrote the script for Little Woods when she was in her early 20s. And then it was one of the 12 projects chosen for the 2015 Sundance Screenwriters and Directors Lab. Wow. So she funded the short film version of Little Woods and then it became her first feature. So I'm really seeing a lot of parallels. Like, I'm not even going to lie. I'm not trying to hype you up like this. I'm just saying you came out of film school. You did your short film. Cause of course, a lot of the times we've seen that. We've seen it with Lights Out. We've seen it with all these different films where they start off with a short. Same thing with Destin Daniel Cretton in Short Term 12. It starts off with a short until they're able to get the budget to create their feature.
Same thing with Ryan Coogler with his short film, yeah. Fig, you know, he did at USC, ends up getting him into the Sundance thing, and where he wrote the script for Fruitvale Station in the Sundance writing lab.
Yeah, and that's definitely always an achievement. And of course, she is able to make her first feature, Little Woods. So Little Woods stars Tessa Thompson and Lily James. They're estranged sisters. They live in North Dakota in like a very, very small town. And we're dealing with a lot of different themes and ideas in this one. And I do think it's a very deep and introspective look into kind of like this like middle America, you know, like kind of like poverty level situation. I want to toss it over to you, RB3. When it comes to Little Woods and Tessa Thompson and Lily James' performance, I think this might be my favorite performance I've ever seen from Lily James and Tessa Thompson. And they're like seasoned actors. They've been in a lot of stuff, but they truly shine within this work. And of course, we know a director is able to bring out these performances in their actors. You need a great director behind the camera. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think they're both really, really great. Yeah, that probably is some of my favorite performances for them, because I think they really honed in on the troubled sibling relationship between them, right? The adopted sibling relationship of having one who was having Tessa Thompson's character who was adopted, having less of a connection to their mother's house and like their mother, you know, well, at least from Lily James' perspective, Tessa Thompson has less of a regard for the house and all that stuff. But in reality, Tessa Thompson was really putting in a lot of the back work and the labor, taking care of the mom in her later stages of life. So it goes kind of both ways. But I think having that like conflict really accentuates like why they need to stick together for like this situation. You know, why they need to, you know, when Lily James' character finds out that she's pregnant, they both get rally together and try to figure out ways to get money and, you know, take care of the situation in like the safest ways they think is possible. Now, like, does it ultimately work out like the best ways? Like, obviously not, but that just goes to show like it's really hard being poor, you know, like, yeah. It's really hard not being able to afford the basic necessities of just, you know, being pregnant and being able to raise a kid. Mm-hmm. Like being so poor that you can't even like afford to raise a kid, like that's really tough. And that's unfortunately the reality that a lot of people live in. So I like that it dealt with that. I love that it dealt with, I just love that their performances were just so deep and thorough and giving like all of those like outward conflicts, like internalized within their acting.
Yeah. Their dynamic is really incredible because both of them just like see the world so very differently. The second that Lily James finds out that she is pregnant, Tessa Thompson immediately, who is on probation currently for drug running in the past, she drops everything and does what she has to do in order to pay for the house and all these other things to kind of tie these loose ends together of their life in this moment. Of course, she's almost done with probation and she's stepping into this new chapter of her life, but she risks all of that, everything she's done up until this point, just to help her sister and to help their entire situation, because they are the only two that they really have. Like that's their family, that's their relationship. So it's that struggle. And we see those moments, we see the scenes where they're yelling at each other. Tessa Thompson kind of has like a close run-in with her probation officer as she continues drug running again. And she puts like the money and the pills at her sister's house because he wouldn't like look over there. And the trailer ends up getting towed because she wasn't paying for it. And so she's just, you see that dynamic in that fight that happens after that. You see how like Tessa Thompson sees Lily James as irresponsible. And with some of the decisions that we've seen in this film. Yeah. And then Lily James saying that like Tessa Thompson loves to piece everything back together and like the glue that like holds it all and loves to like see herself in that way, like as a step above and a step higher. And that's what we've seen throughout the entire film. But at the end of the day, because of the decisions that they make with each other, like we know it's all love. Like there is just genuine, unconditional love there no matter what. And it's always a struggle when you have someone in your family, like the matriarch or somebody like that pass. It really is something that can like break apart relationships, especially when the relationship was already basically broken anyway. So the fact that they came together like this through these hard times rather than separating further, I just think it's a really beautiful thing. And the stuff that it deals with, like you mentioned, healthcare. we're dealing with Lily James's kind of like pursuit of an abortion. She was going to go through with, or she was like exploring her options, and she found out how much it was going to cost for her to have a baby, which I remember the doctor was saying was like thousands, like tens of thousands of dollars, basically like 9,000 or something. Mm-hmm. And she knows that that is not sustainable for her, that she's unable to do that. And it is really, really unfortunate, because the only, it's either you pay this money or you terminate your pregnancy, but then that's also difficult and that's also costly. And they have to go on a lot of situations where they're putting themselves at risk and in danger of different things, whether it's safety, health, all this kind of stuff, in order to get. So it's like both sides aren't ideal, you know? And of course it is like, it's like a mistake. It's something that happens to people sometimes. And like this film coming out years ago kind of set the stage for where we are right now. Of course, like this is in the news. Everyone is talking about this all the time, abortion laws all over, because as we see in this film, as we've seen in recent films, like Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, Unpregnant, so many different ones, we've seen the lengths people will go because the other option just does not seem viable for them. And, you know, either way, this is something that a lot of people say, either way, abortions are going to still happen, whether they happen under the table at somebody's house, kind of like what we see in a scene with this film that's almost attempted. Like they're going to happen anyways. So we're letting young women or whatever put themselves at risk in all these different ways just to do something that for some reason the country doesn't think that they're able to do, or their specific states and regions. It's really sad.
Yeah, I think that's one of like the heartbreaking truths that the movie really emphasizes, and how the system is just broken and, you know, not really protecting the people that they're claiming to look out for. Same thing with the PO officer, you know, even though the PO officer overall, he's a good dude. He's just looking out for, you know, and he's just looking out for Tessa Thompson's character and whatnot. Ultimately, in the end, he ultimately does. But, you know, just that general stress of like having like a supervisor to check in with every day, like to, you know, when you're like, outside of prison, like you're incarcerated, but like in the real world too, I'm still constrained to like certain areas and can't do certain things. But meanwhile, the only way you can survive in this environment is through doing the illegal stuff, is through the going to Canada and getting the drugs. And that's also another truth that they confront really well too. The cost of like the prescription drugs and how it's just massively inflated in the United States as compared to a place like Canada, where they have like universal healthcare and they have better like drug laws and stuff like that. So, you know, they tackle both the issue of abortion. They tackle the issue of both abortion and of prescription drugs, and both, and make them both, you know, seemingly what, you know, they seem like they're not like the most like related, but it intertwines them in the most like relatable way, because it is ultimately something that if you legalize both, if you legalize a lot more drugs and you regulate drugs a lot better, people wouldn't have to go through those situations too. Like they wouldn't have to be gone illegally across the border and risking their probation and having to face time in jail or losing their house because of not being able to, you know, get certain drugs that they need to pay for, or just for having drugs to begin with. Like why, like the concept of, you know, weed and like other drugs just being illegal just doesn't even make that much sense to begin with. So I love that this movie has such deep themes, but also keeps it to such a personal level between these two siblings. So I think Nia DaCosta did a really amazing job with Little Woods, and is definitely a really strong debut. I think that's definitely a great kickoff point for having a career that leads to movies like Candyman and the Captain Marvel sequels. So
yeah, when you can pack this much emotion and just like very visceral feelings and all different things, anger, frustration, us knowing that this is a reality in this country and in places all over the world, whether it is like we said, like they are poor. And a lot of the times with all these situations in this movie, if they were more well off, they wouldn't be going through it. They wouldn't have to, Tessa Thompson wouldn't have to go back to being a drug runner just to pay for the house that their mother like had. And this is something that they need, and it means a lot to them and their family. And like, of course, it's a basic human need is shelter. And even like the shelter Lily James had in the film, which was the trailer, like got taken away from her. And so like all of this could have been avoided, even like the abortion. Like there's people in some states where it's not available, but if they have money, they can fly somewhere else, or they can do something else more safely than this, like doing it under the table. At the end of the day, they end up using a different ID, and Lily James is able to have the procedure done using somebody else's like insurance. And of course, all of this is shady. The drug running is shady, but it's what they need to do to survive. And that really, really hones it in of like how difficult it is to navigate through certain elements of life when you're just kind of like behind in certain areas. It's really, really sad.
Yeah, no. And I think that's the truth for a lot of people. I think that's the truth for the vast majority of people in this country. And I think that's these are the stories that don't get told a lot. And I'm glad that this was told in such a powerful and profound way. It's very underrated. I highly recommend people see it. If you have Hulu, it's available on Hulu to watch. So shout out to Hulu, shout out to Neon for also, you know, producing and distributing it as well. I think it's really, I think if you're looking for like a real list, like a real gritty, like emotional kind of, in film school, they will call this like a like quote unquote problem film, or like, yeah, a problem film, which is like just a film purely about like social problems or like economic problems and stuff like that. And how that affects people like on an individual level. And this is definitely fits like perfectly into that. Like it's something that like really highlights like what middle America lifestyle is like, but also why is that so universal to everybody else in so many other ways. So
exactly. And that's why this one's definitely a high recommend from both of us. And we had to talk about it today. It also, it premiered at Tribeca Film Festival in 2018, and it actually got the Nora Ephron Award for excellence in storytelling by a female director or writer. So it's nice. Definitely, yeah, a very accomplished place to kind of start your career, and deservingly so, because this film tackles a lot of really interesting stuff. But then next up, we got a few years in between, of course, COVID delayed some things and all of that, but we get her second feature, Candyman, which was highly anticipated by so many people across the internet and everything. Everyone was talking about this film because, of course, we've kind of talked about like remakes, reboots, later sequels, and how that can kind of like alter and change franchises, update it and like modernize it. So we have Candyman. RB3, I want to toss it to you. It's you're only here. What are your thoughts on the newest iteration of Candyman?
I mean, you know, my thoughts on the newest iteration of Candyman. That's funny because like we talked about it on our first cut live stream, you know, when it first came out. And when it first came out, I was a little more like lukewarm on it. I was like, you know, I didn't really love it as much. I didn't think it was scary. It's not the greatest in terms of, I felt like it wasn't the greatest in terms of like actually being a great scary movie. And then of course, like people on social media cursed me out, told me, Rob, you stupid. You're not looking at the movie deep enough. Like the themes are there, da 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 da. And upon like really like thinking about it and sitting with it and like evaluating it, I do realize like, yeah, there are a lot of good themes here. I do like the themes that they are tackling. I don't think the theme of gentrification is really something that's brought up a lot in cinema, like at all. And it's funny because I think there are a lot of movies. There's not a lot, but there's content that's being created now in 2019, 2020, 2021 that deals with themes of like generational trauma and like slavery and like the sentence of that. And, you know, of course there's movies, there's obviously stuff like the shows like Watchmen and Lovecraft Country that are more on the sci-fi side. And then, you know, Harriet, you know, there's more of like a realistic movie, and even that, abysmal movie, Antebellum even kind of touches on that too. Like the generational trauma thing. But I think this movie really like honed in and defined it in a really like brilliant way too, because it kind of establishes, and it does so brilliantly by using the previously 1992 Candyman as like as the canon for that, right? Like showing how every generation, every 30 years, there is going to be a new evolution of this kind of figure, because it's going to keep getting forgotten throughout the history books. In the same way that personally I had forgotten the 1992 Candyman, like I hadn't really cared about it or seen it too much about it until like leading up into the remake time. So I personally, and you know, and then watching the 1992 movie and revisiting the 2021 film, we had the conversation at the conversation with Ed Greer, which you could check out our last episode, last meeting of episode. We talked about Candyman. So ultimately I come around to it. I really dig it. I still don't think it's that scary, but I guess maybe that's not the point. Like, you know, maybe I shouldn't be scared. Like, maybe it's good that I'm not scared, and maybe white people could be scared at a movie for once, or maybe not just white people, but other people could be scared. I don't know. I'm glad the black person wasn't the first one to die for a first time in a movie. That's good. So that's all I'm saying, you know?
No, I love a lot of the things that you mentioned over there. Like, I mean, I feel like I was scared in the movies just because, like, the atmosphere and the tension that was built and different things like that. I always get kind of like affected by that. I'm not a fan of jump scares. I'm not a fan of like the cheaper scares. And this movie did not have any of that. So I really appreciated it on that front. But yeah, overall, I feel like this is a more accessible film. And I feel like it kind of needs to, in terms of if you're not a fan of horror, you could still watch this one and not be super terrified of it. And I think that's important because we can kind of spread this franchise, this story, these themes and elements to like people that wouldn't necessarily be able to watch it if it was like a true like Hereditary level, just like super scary, another one that dealt with like trauma throughout a family. But this one's definitely really interesting. And I think watching Little Woods around the same time as this Candyman, you get a lot of these sensibilities because Nia DaCosta is able to very much so ground this horror film with all the themes that you mentioned earlier. And she's able to bring that out into the forefront. And it kind of ends up being so much deeper than just your regular slasher film, because this one is, I wouldn't even call it a slasher film because it's just like so much. It essentially is at the end of the day, because that's the villain of this film is Candyman. But at the same time, he's not. And there's just so much more. And it's like society and all these different ideas and the way people look at some others. And we get that through the eyes of Anthony. Whether you're watching this for the first time and this is what makes you being introduced to like the mythos of Candyman, it dives in so much deeper than the original films did. And that's what I think is almost like a little bit scarier about it. Anthony, he is a struggling artist in a city that is being like gentrified all the time. And just constantly neighborhood, people that live in this area are being like displaced, people that grew up there in order for some other people to just like move to the city and live out their dreams and attempt all these different things. But Anthony is kind of in a struggle because his work hasn't been put out into like the forefront for a while. He hasn't really been celebrated as an artist, and he's definitely in a rut. And that's like the parallel between him and Candyman, because Candyman has to be talked about. He has to be discussed in order for him to live on. If you're not talking about him, then he's not active. He's not, you know, like it's really important for the community and the people. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. He's not remembered. Like his presence is not there. If he's not talked about, if people don't remember and speak on his legacy, that's, you know, people forget. And that is just like the legacy of Black people, the history of Black people, the history of slavery, like the history of, that's why critical race theory and all these things are so important to talk about now, because if you don't talk about the history, what happened in the past, you're never going to remember you're never going to anticipate what's going to happen in the future. And if you don't remember who Candyman is, he's going to come back to bite you. So, you know.
Exactly. And that's why it also is just like one of those things where like in school, it's so important. I know so many people who had an education where large chunks of history are just absolutely like deleted from the timeline. They never hear about it, but history has a tendency to repeat itself. But if we look back at other history and then we're able to be like, obviously this is all wrong and made aware of mistakes of the past of our country, instead of like trying to look through with rose colored glasses or anything, that's when you really learn, that's when you progress, and that's when you grow. So it never really made sense to me, that kind of idea, but Candyman and Anthony, definitely we have that parallel between the two, because he is super inspired by his legacy, by that urban legend and that story. And he has this connection with him immediately, and he's able to draw inspiration. And even when it's kind of criticized by the art critic, and she's just kind of like, all right, like, yeah, this was like trying to be deep, but didn't necessarily 100% go for it. And, you know, it's kind of difficult when you're so engulfed into a project or something like that. But then that's when, you know, like he goes to talk to her. And in my opinion, we have like my favorite kill of the movie. I know that's morbid to say, but for horror fans, like this is, you know, this is something you talk about. My favorite kill because of the way it's shot and directed, and Nia DaCosta's use of mirrors and that kind of like imagery to really build that tension and that atmosphere. And so for this one, we have the shot, which is actually funny because my friend used to work in that building, you know, like the two round buildings in Chicago. My friend like worked there. I'm from Chicago for anyone who doesn't know. So I knew about Candyman. People would talk about this franchise and these movies as if it was real. And they would be like spreading that urban legend as well, which was something I was terrified by. But yeah, so I do really appreciate like seeing like different parts of the city and that building in general, because that sequence, when they go outside of those two buildings and we see her death, it's almost like scarier to me than being there in the situation with her, because we don't have the sound, because we don't have her reactions as we're seeing this go down. It's like left to our own imagination of like what that would be like. And I don't know, that like kind of scares me a little bit more. What are some standout moments to you?
Just going back to like that conversation with the art critic, I think that that's also another like really poignant moment, because like you said, she didn't understand the art. She said it was like deep and didn't really have any value without having any real understanding of the actual history behind it. Right. Like knowing that there is actually, at least in the canon of the movie, there's like, I don't know, maybe I'm like overestimating, like 15 generations of Candyman before it, from the 1800s all the way, you know, from the original story from Candyman with the bees and all that, going all the way down to this lineage, mad generations of it. And if you haven't caught on to the story and understood the story by now, like there's no point for you. And I think that's the same for, I think, frankly, a lot of critics. I think for a lot of people who look at Black art and from outside perspective without like really understanding like the deepness or the meaningfulness behind it, they look at certain things and they don't understand it because it's not where they're from. That's not their community. That's not their heritage that's being incorporated. And that's just frankly something that they don't understand. And I think that's such a powerful conversation to be had too, because it's hard to explain that to people. Like it's hard to explain why certain movies that are considered Black classics or blastics, as I like to call them, that are considered blastics in my household or certain households have like a 20 or 30% Rotten Tomatoes, you know? Some certain jokes just hit certain ways that just won't be outside of your community. Now, that being said, there is a lot of trash like entertainment too, but I think there should be room for trash entertainment, trash art, and all that kind of stuff as well. Not saying anything that Anthony or Yahya Abdul-Mateen's character was doing in this movie was trash. I thought all of his art was kind of cool. I think that was also another cool detail about it too, how fascinating and how like intense the art itself was. The actual production design and the veracity of it felt like very like old, like 1980s, like amateur, like, you know, I don't want to say, I'm trying to think of particularly like the artist, but some Basquiat, but even like deeper and nastier and darker, like it's sloppier. And it's just really cool. It was really, really great stuff. But I think showing that through his artistic struggle, through his artistic vision and trying to understand himself and his lineage, and then putting that into his art and having the outside world, the critics, the collector, like the art collector, everybody else from the outside look at it and just be like, what is this, dude? That speaks to something too, you know? It speaks to how there's a lack of understanding and critiquing and understanding art from that perspective.
Even like, of course, like everything, especially like art and all of that is very subjective, but there's been a history of specific type of people that work. It's kind of very elitist. We've talked about before how like theater, painting, classical music, all these different kinds of forms of art, like it just has a specific history behind it. So a lot of the times, and the film industry as well, like kind of like what you mentioned, you know, like critics look at it from their own particular lens, and everything is subjective, but at the same time, you have to understand all the different perspectives of what something like this is trying to tackle. And if you don't see it and you don't get it, then like, maybe like educate yourself, learn more, figure out a different way of looking at it. And so, yeah, that conversation with the art critic is definitely really, really great, because I feel like we're headed towards a better direction in terms of how like elite, all of this is, you know, like with like classical music, painting, filmmaking, whatever it may be, theater. But yeah, that one was definitely really interesting, and it led to my favorite kill. And the thing is, the critic wasn't a bad person. Like, we're meeting her, mm-hmm. and she's fine. She's not, she's just like a snob. And that's something that we come across a lot in like all different industries of like art.
Right. Exactly. And I mean, you know, none, again, it was no indictment towards the critic, but I mean, I think just that conversation is dope to have. I also think some of my favorite supporting characters that I never mentioned, Tiana Paris's brother, and his boyfriend were just Nathan like, absolutely. Jarrett. Yeah. They're just hilarious to me whenever they cut to those scenes. I thought they were really great. I liked the scene and I like the Candyman scene in the high school when like all of the kids were like, all the girls were in the girls' room getting ready to do the Candyman thing, and then and like the little Asian girl ran out like right after the fourth one. I thought that was funny. And then the one girl they were picking on, the black girl that they were picking on in the thing, you know, got off scot-free. So I just thought all that stuff was really, really interesting and dope. A lot of great scenes and a lot of great, it was really well shot. I thought it was really well shot. I thought it was really well choreographed. Like, you know, I think you mentioned it a little bit in our first cut live, but there's some things that are reminiscent of like The Invisible Man, like in terms of like the camera work and like the creativity and like how they navigated with that. Like, particularly I think at the end with the cops, when they're summoned at the end, like against the cops, spoiler alert, by the way, I don't know if people should have seen it by now.
this is a spoiler warning.
Spoiler filled. I liked it though. I really dug a lot of it. And I'm glad it's making the money and being as successful as it is right now.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned, like Lee Wan L's The Invisible Man, 'cause that's another like property, long running franchise, of course. And it's really interesting to have these filmmakers take on these modernized approaches and really just add something really extraordinary and unique to these films, because this is so, even though this is a sequel and it is very much so connected and there's a lot of references, at the same time, it really just like kind of pivoted. Like, if we are going to have another film, if this were to continue, it's in a completely brand new direction. And that's what it needs to be refreshing when we're dealing with these like remakes, reboots, sequels. I want to talk about Colman Domingo's character, because I feel like that has a lot of discussion as well. I want to get your thoughts on the way that we're introduced to him and his kind of journey.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that I still like don't understand. I think that, you know, I think this movie is probably the one movie that I'll ever say that like could have been a little bit longer, actually. Yes. Maybe if they put just maybe one or two more scenes with Colman Domingo, like maybe him secretly plotting behind the scenes, because the twist seemed out of nowhere. Maybe it shouldn't have seemed out of nowhere, because we do establish that he, you know, saw the original Candyman and received the candy. We saw that OG Candyman from his community, like also killed a sister and the boyfriend dude that she was with. So obviously like he knows a lot about Candyman, like from just witnessing that. I'm just curious as to what would persuade him to try to recreate Candyman. Like, that's the only part that I'm like a little bit, the logic jump was a little bit interesting to me, mm-hmm. but overall, look, you know, Colman Domingo, he likes my tweets. He liked a couple of my tweets. Every time I'm like, really? Colman Domingo. Yeah, I tweeted. I was like, when Zola came out, I was like, Colman Domingo deserves an Oscar. And then he liked it. I was like, yes. And then I tweeted something else and he liked it too. I was like, oh, Colman Domingo, let's go. I think it was something about Ma Rainey or something. And then
I nominated him for Ma Rainey's, because he is a fantastic actor. I feel like if anybody else was in this role in this movie, it might not work, but Colman Domingo, if someone's going to go for it, it's going to be Colman Domingo. And
he absolutely went
for it and he sold it. But yeah, when I think about what this character may like represent, because he's like one of the first people that we're introduced to really. And then, yeah, it ends up being that twist. Since he was the cause of the death of like Sherman, I feel like he had, of course, like a lot of guilt because Sherman was innocent and that's what they ended up finding out. And so of course, like that probably weighs very heavily on you. And then also again, dealing with him, but with, from his sister's death, it's like, I feel like there's just a lot to kind of drive you a little bit mad and also want to not lose a piece of this history and who this person is and to continue that on. So that's what he kind of like represents to me. But yeah, Colman Domingo's performance, absolutely incredible. Every performance here, like you mentioned, Tiana Paris, Yahya Abdul-Mateen, I think they all did a really, really incredible job, especially like you mentioned, with it being only about an hour and a half. I would have honestly liked to see like 10, 15 more minutes, tie up a little bit of loose ends, like establish motives just a little bit more. And I think I would have rocked with it because it did make a really hard pivot at that twist that made me think for a second.
Right, right. But I did, you know, it was a hard pivot, but I do appreciate that there wasn't, you know, they didn't like have this film speed us like at any point throughout the film too. Yeah. Like, I do like that there wasn't like some sort of like cheesy monologue. I mean, there was a little bit of a monologue towards the end, but there wasn't like, I guess there wasn't like a overly obvious, like mustache twirly, like villain. Mm-hmm. Because I think at the end of the day, the bad guy is society. The bad guy is the act of gentrification. The bad guy is how, you know, there were these previous projects, Calabrese Green, that were previously projects, ultimately end up getting, you know, projects for poor people, Black people, ultimately ends up having those poor Black people displaced for younger white hipsters, not younger white or non, you know, Black, you know, hipsters moving into this community for cheap, ultimately ended up raising the prices themselves. And now this Black couple are seemingly outsiders to what was originally their own community, and that legacy being lost. And that's frankly what gentrification is. It's the loss of legacy. It's the loss of heritage. I was just talking about it at work with some coworkers today too. Like, look at what, the reason why Fairfax has like this reputation now of like being the streetwear mm-hmm. brand, the streetwear place, is because back in the 90s and early 2000s, that was really the only spot that like Black and brown people and Asian people were hanging out. Like, they weren't really going to West Hollywood. They weren't really going to other spots in LA. They were hanging out on Fairfax because A, some of the clothes there were cool, and B, like, there were just, that just wasn't like considered, it was like close to mid city, which is an area that is pretty close to Inglewood, in West or LA area near Baldwin Hills, that was like a predominantly Black area in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. But again, as gentrification comes in, those areas gets displaced, and also the streetwear culture ends up, you know, getting commodified into its own kind of thing.
Adopted
by, you know, hipsters, by hype beast, by people with a lot of money, and then the prices on that jack up, and now Fairfax is completely different, like, you know, than it used to be. So that's ultimately what this stuff is. Like, that's what this cultural, you know, gentrification is, and that stems from actual physical gentrification. So it's just very powerful. You can forget a legacy about a place like real quick, and I think that's, you know, when you look at Fairfax now, when you look at Echo Park, people don't know Echo Park was a predominantly mm-hmm. Latino area. People don't know that, you know, I talk about this all the time, but Dodger Stadium was a whole community of Mexican Americans living like at the property that the city of Los Angeles specifically designated for them, ultimately being displaced and promised more property and never given it. And, you know, that's just, unfortunately, the reality. Same thing, you know, a little bit of Disneyland in Anaheim is the same situation. Anaheim used to be a lot of strawberry farms or a lot of farmers. Now it's Disneyland. So that's ultimately what society is. That's what society breeds. That's what capitalism breeds. But it has detrimental effects, and people ultimately forget what the history of a place is. And it's not good to forget history. So.
Yeah. And I know, like, we're from LA. So like a lot of this, like these different stories about like Fairfax and Echo Park, of course, like we're right here and we're there and we know the history, but there's so many others throughout America that it is insane finding out about these decades later. We have like Lake Lanier in Georgia, that was literally a thriving Black community. And it's now a man-made lake. And every single person that lived there was completely displaced. And it's something that now, like, people are chilling with, like, tubes and, like, all this other stuff and, like, catching a tan over there. And people were displaced for a man-made lake. Central Park was the same situation. There's so many different areas. I definitely encourage everybody to learn about, like, the history of their towns and their communities and bringing these things out to light, because this was stuff that people didn't talk about up until, like, very recently, where it's just kind of something that it's like, hey, have you heard about this? Because if not, you really should know, like, about Central Park, another thriving Black community that's displaced for a park in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah, no, and I think I've heard like a lot about Central Park and all that stuff, but yeah, I didn't even think to bring that up. But yeah, that's a key example of like what that is. So again, people, I hope like Candyman inspires this conversation to continue. I'm glad that it's bringing this stuff to the forefront. I think, you know, having this socially aware, like, new kind of style of horror is really, I think, interesting. I think it gives an added layer, an added introduction for people who aren't talking about these topics to talk about them in their households through the power of cinema. So I love it. And salute to Nita Costa for, you know, putting together a really, really awesome Candyman reboot. So
definitely super refreshing. It focuses on a very important conversation, something very impactful. And then it also opens the door for other filmmakers and people exploring all different genres to be able to tackle stuff that is very topical. We see it with both Candyman and Little Woods as well. So shout out to Nita Costa for that. But like we mentioned earlier, like we alluded to, Nita Costa, her next project is The Marvels. I believe they say that it's going to come out at the end of 2022. So about a year from now, basically. I believe it's November. So it was announced about a year ago, August 2020. It was announced that she'd be directing it. What do you want to see? Because this is the sequel to Captain Marvel, but we are going to see some other characters kind of roped into this one. What do you expect from Nita Costa's take on The Marvels?
Well, I mean, I think we're obviously going to see, I'm really excited to see Kamala Khan. That's one of my like newer favorite characters. She's the Muslim Pakistani American like teenager from like New Jersey. And I'm literally reading this directly from marvel.fandom.com. So, and I'm not going to fake like I'm not reading that from somewhere. But Kamala Khan is I'm introduced to her from the Avengers video game, like in the recent Avengers video game that they put out. She's like kind of the POV character for like the first half of the story. So like you kind of follow through her perspective. I think it's really cool having a young Muslim Pakistani character who has, who is like flexible. She's almost I don't want to say Elastigirl because like she's not like super flexible. It's just her hands. Like her hands like get really big and she could punch really hard, stuff like that. I just think her powers are really cool. Like, I just think they're very visually dynamic. I like her costume. I love, I also really am really excited to see Tiana Paris's character. Mm-hmm. Spectrum, I believe, is her superhero name. I feel like they really shafted her a lot in WandaVision. At least according to reports, there were some reshoots that they were intended to have that included more of her, but unfortunately because of COVID and situations, they couldn't like get to that. But I'm curious to see like where her actual powers are. You know, we just saw her eat a couple bullets and just keep it pushing last time, but I'm really curious to see like what her actual thing's going to be. So.
Yeah. I'm excited for Nita Costa to kind of take on a lot of these characters and have this film. I really hope that, you know, that she's able to let her vision and her voice, because even in this, like her taking on two different genres with like more this like independent film, what you called like the problem film, like I love that. I love that term for it. And then Candyman as well, like a horror film, what she was able to do with both of those, but at the same time, the themes were so topical and they resonated. Like, I want to see some of that with the Marvels because we do have these characters. We have Tiana Paris and then Kamala Khan. And I feel like there's a lot to really explore there. And Nita Costa's voice, as young as she is, being 31 years old and having a very young but established career, I do feel like she has created a specific like tone and filmmaking style, all these different things. And that's something I really, really want to see shine. Now that we saw, because I think when we first talked about Candyman, we didn't see like Shang-Chi yet. I'm really excited for this next phase in Marvel. Of course, this is going to be part of phase four, because Destin Daniel Cretton taking this one on, he was able to bring his sensibilities into that one. So I'm expecting a lot of the same for this film.
Yeah, I think 100%. Like, I think there's definitely going to be some sort of bigger theme here. I'm kind of curious as to what, because as pertaining to, Candyman and Little Woods, both very different films, tackle very, very different subjects, and really subject material that you really wouldn't think that they would even necessarily like mesh together in, you know? So I'm curious to see like what the personal connection is going to be. Cause I feel like that was, I liked the first Captain Marvel, but I felt like there was a little bit of like, oh, this takes place in the 90s. We know everything's going to be okay because, you know, we're going to be moving forward. And there wasn't like a lot of like the big, like real world for me. Like, I love Marvel movies that deal with like culture and that deal with like real world, kind of themes. Like, I love that Black Panther deals with, like how society kind of, how racism in general, and also how society, doesn't have a lot of resources for Black people in a lot of different countries. I love that Shang-Chi deals with the ideas of family and toxicity in family, and like how that legacy and imperialism, like on a greater metaphorical theme. Obviously, Captain America, the Winter Soldier, spy, espionage, but also like surveillance, political and all that stuff.
Thriller.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I want to see what her genre is going to be, and also what her theme is going to be too. You know what I mean? Because I like I'm really, really stoked for, like, I loved how, I feel like Shang-Chi was one of the most expressive Marvel movies that we've gotten in a while. Like, it didn't feel, it almost felt like maybe the studio had a few notes here and there, like maybe included a couple of scenes here and there, but it felt the most, it, to me, it felt like the most like solo movie in like a long time for Marvel. Like, I feel like I could take my grandma to see Shang-Chi and she won't be confused as to like why this character's here, or who's that, or who's that, you know? Like, it's a pretty straightforward thing. So I hope that maybe this one could be another one of that too.
Yeah, I almost feel like phase four is like, of course we have a lot of threads that are continuing on, but I feel like it's also a very clean slate creatively. I feel like they don't have a lot that's kind of like holding them back. So I'm very excited, because I mean, about a year from now, we'll be sitting on this channel talking about what we saw and what we think of the Marvels. So I mean, that's going to come up much sooner rather than later. So I'm very, very excited for that. But with that, RB3, thank you so much for hanging out with me today to talk about Nia DaCosta. Very excited, because we did talk about Candyman. So if you guys want to check out that discussion on First Cut Live, but also RB3's discussion with Ed Greer is also on the channel. So be sure you check that out as well. Ed Greer is awesome. But yeah, I'm Sabrina. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at SabrinaXMonica. Also on Twitter at SabrinaOnFilm. You can follow First Cut at FirstCutTMO on Twitter and Instagram. Subscribe to the channel. Drop us a like. Save our podcast. Do all the things. But RB3, where can the good people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at DirectorRB3. And you can also find Timestamp on Twitter at Timestamp Movie and Instagram Timestamp Movie. Again, film, you know, we're just getting into film festivals and things again working out. Also, another, you know, I feel like another key crucial part that, you know, we talked a little bit about Nia DaCosta's backstory, how she graduated from film school and made it. That's really dope. As a film school graduate, I think that's dope. And I just want to encourage people. I know there's a lot of people out there struggling right now. It's like, make it through film school. It's expensive, all that kind of stuff. Definitely like push through it, get through it. It's definitely worth it at the end in the long run. So especially if you're Black, you know, or brown or whatever you are, you know, we need you in this industry. So definitely keep it pushing.
100%. And on that beautiful note, for the First Cut crew, we are peacing out with this episode of The Meaning Of on Nia DaCosta.